Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Infinite Potential podcast. Today, we are with Ellis Stewart, who is a world-renowned public speaker through his exploits in mountaineering. In 2014 and 2015, he survived two of the worst disasters in the history of Mount Everest, climbing whilst attempting to reach the summit. He's also an entrepreneur, allowing him to self-fund his summit attempts with very little sponsorship. Ellis, thanks a lot for joining us. How are you doing?
You're welcome. Hi, how are you doing, guys?
Good, thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, no problem at all.
So, Ellis, what made you want to climb Everest in the first place?
Million-dollar question.
I'm giving a lot of reasons why not to climb it.
But. Yeah,
so I talk to my wife as well, to be fair. it was, for me, it got to a point where it was... It became part of my makeup, really. I'd read that much about the mountain for a long, long sort of period of my life. And I got to a point where I knew that I wanted to one day go and see Everest. If not climb it, I just wanted to actually go and see the mountain. Because as a boy growing up, you get to hear about, you know, escapades that people get involved with, you know, the likes of Ed Hillary and... That British, when the Brits successful in reaching the top of Everest in 1953 during the Queen's coronation, and all that sort of stuff just sort of fascinated me as I was growing up. And these were the type of images and posters that I had on my bedroom wall as a kid growing up. You know, I kind of shunned the traditional football type posters. I had sort of pictures of mountaineers and stuff on my walls. It was just something that I knew from a young age that I was deeply passionate about and really, really interested in. And it went from there, really. It was just something that stayed with me. And as I got older, I started to look seriously at it and wonder, could I actually possibly do this myself? Could I go and have a crack at Everest?
Yeah. So when was the turning point that you thought, yeah, I'm going to go have a go at this?
Possibly, I would say the first attempt I actually made on the mountain was probably around about 2000, 2001, where I actually started to get into proper sort of mountaineering. And it's only after I'd got a couple of climbs under my belt that I suddenly started to think, this could be a reality. You know, I've fared okay so far, so something could happen and could come from this. So I mean, my journey to Everest was a long, long, long journey. It wasn't... something that sort of happened overnight. I mean, I came up with this dream to climb this mountain, as I say, from probably the back end of 98, 99, going into 2000. And it took me a long, long time to reach the mountain.
Had you done many climbs prior to attempting Everest?
Yeah, I mean, I was the traditional route into Everest. I mean, the one thing I will say is my experience going into the Everest expeditions was probably not as full and as varied as some people attempting this thing. In my book, I've referred to myself as a lazy mountaineer, really. I think I did the bare minimum that was required to get myself into the position to have a shot at Everest, because I was confident with my abilities. I knew that Everest wasn't technically a very challenging mountain, and I knew that fitness-wise, it was probably well within my capabilities. So growing up, where I grew up in the northeast of England, I didn't really have an awful lot of chance to engage in sort of climbing and mountaineering trips every other week. So I did what was required of me, and my experience was just enough, I think, that got me into a prime position to attempt the mountain.
Cool. So let's talk, was it 2014? Was that the initial...
Yeah, 2014 was the first attempt on the mountain. I'd been to Everest prior. I mean, I'd been over to the mountain in 2000. That was as a trekker. So we just wandered up to the mountain just to have a look at it and to, you know, just to see what it's all about. And it took me 14 years to actually get back to that base camp to then actually have that, what I was hoping would have been the one and only attempt to reach the top of the mountain.
But was there much doubt setting in when you saw it for the first time?
I guess there is, because when you get to Everest, there's a classic viewpoint that most people aim to go. So ironically, if you go to base camp on the mountain's south side, so we're talking in Nepal here, you can't actually see Everest. So you're sort of base camp and mixing with the climbers, and you don't actually get a view of the mountain itself. So you have to go to a nearby sort of little hill, if you like. It's called Kalapata, and it's quite a famous viewpoint. So from the top of this hill, you get a classic view of the upper stretches of the mountain. So in 2000, I got to the top of Kalapata to see everything. And I had a blinding headache brought on by the altitude. And I didn't linger too long. I was up there for about a minute. I thought, oh, crikey, you know, if I feel like this here, I've kind of got no chance up there on the mountain. So my first sight of Everest wasn't great, to be fair.
How many feet is that base camp?
Base camp is about 5,300 metres, which is around about 17,500 feet. So that's pretty high. Just to put that into perspective, just to stand at the bottom of Mount Everest, you're higher than anywhere in Europe. So you're higher than any of the Alps by, you know, 3,000 feet.
That's
so
just
you're already, that's just at the bottom, yeah. So you're already scaling a significant height just to reach the bottom of Everest. And I think that's why it's such a popular challenge and a lot of people like to do it, because it just to reach Everest itself it is difficult. You know, you've got to put up with that extreme altitude that it takes just to get there.
So how high is Everest if that's 5,000 meters?
To the top of the mountains, 8,848 meters. So from base camp, you've still got pretty much another 3,500 meters to go to reach the summit. So it's an you get no real appreciation of how big the mountain is until you get into Nepal and you can see it in the distance, and it is just vast. I mean, the scale of this mountain is just staggering. It's, you know, I know it's the highest mountain in the world, but it's massive. I mean, everything about the peak is huge. Obviously, no more so than the altitude. So the summit of the mountain itself, it points into the jet stream. So those you know, constant 200 mile an hour winds that sort of that commercial airliners use to fly around the world, Everest actually sits in that. So you know, you can imagine being that high, and you know, physically, it's that gives you an idea as to the scale of the challenge.
Do you want to take us through that first attempt?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in 2014, I had no, you know, attempts to come back. For me, it was a one-off opportunity. Everything that had happened to get me to that stage. So the money had came together, obviously the fitness had come together. So I was ready to go and to have this one attempt. So on our way into the mountain, we had a 19-day trekking period with myself, and obviously I was quite a small-knit team that was there to climb the mountain. We were about a day out from reaching Everest, so we'd been trekking through Nepal, you know, slowly increasing our altitude, getting closer and closer to the mountain, and we were literally one day out from reaching the tents and reaching like the business end of the trip, if you like. So we were in a lodge, just sort of relaxing and chilling out in a Lobashir was the settlement, the Nepalese settlement that we'd reached to. And while we were there, one of our sort of porters was over on the other side of the kitchen. He was looking a bit sort of shifty and a bit nervous. And he came over to us, and he was the first person to inform us that there'd been an incident lower down on the mountain. And what had effectively happened is the Sherpas that fixed the route for Everest. So, I mean, people like myself and Western climbers, we can't really climb this mountain without the help and support of the Nepalese. I mean, it's paramount that we have these guys on our side. And it wouldn't happen without them. So these guys were up on the mountain route fixing, and we're getting some of the camps in position. It was quite early in the season. And they were I think there was about 25 of these guys were on a section of the mountain called the Khumbu Ice Fault, which is quite an infamous part of the route through Nepal. A section of aluminium ladder that we used to cross the ice fall had come away. So they'd reached a gaping, you know, chasm, if you like, where the crevasse was, and then they couldn't go any further. So while they were waiting for a new section of ladder to be brought up, they kind of just mingled around and took the packs off, and unfortunately they were kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, because a huge section of ice on the west shoulder of Everest directly above them carved off the mountain and came crashing down on top of them. When all was said and done, there was about 16 were killed. 16 of the 25 that were there were killed, and the rest were you know, seriously injured. So we that news started filtering down to us when we were one day away from reaching the mountain. So obviously you can imagine what that does to your mindset and to, you know, to the belief and wanting to do this dream. So we following day we reached the mountain and decided and looked into what was happening. And it was a very, very fraught time. I mean, we sat there for a week on Everest in 2014 while the mountain was effectively on shutdown. Nobody was going up or down. Nobody seemed to want to go up in light of the action, what had actually happened on the mountain. And it became, to be part of that, and it was, you know, it was very, very tragic. And it sort of showed you the sheer power and the danger of the mountain. You know, as I say, before we'd even got going, really, there was 16 people killed. And that incident became the biggest loss of life on the mountain in history, really. There hadn't been a bigger, at the time, there hadn't been a bigger event that claimed more lives. So that really plays on your mind. I mean, I spent 7 days on Everest with the rest of the team, wondering if we were going to get an opportunity to climb. Did we want to climb? You know, what was actually happening? And then after about 7-8 days of waiting, the decision was taken that every team on the mountain was going to... We knew that we were no longer able to climb the mountain, because what happened is there was threats were being made to some of our Sherpas and some of our support climbers that if they continued on with expeditions, i.e. supporting the Western climbers, that their livelihoods would be at stake, that, you know, there was physical threats of violence made to their families, and the whole situation was becoming untenable, really. Mm. So we couldn't place, you know, put our Sherpa staff and our Nepali mountain workers at risk. No one was prepared to run that gambit. So through a tragic series of events, you know, through the initial collapse in the icefall, and then through this political hijacking which these mountain workers used against their government, 2014 was a bit of a non-starter, really. I came home after only 4 or 5 weeks of being out in the country, just a bit shell-shocked with everything that happened. Being there, you know, a day away from the mountain when this happened, it certainly leveled you. It made you realise that this is a dangerous mountain, that something like this can just happen like that. And if you are in the wrong place at the wrong time, then... you know, sadly, that the mountain is showing who's boss.
Yeah. Mm. Up until that point, had it all kind of seemed like a bit of a fairy tale until reality hit?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a big, big life's dream of mine. And to finally get that opportunity to be there and to achieve it, it was amazing. It was like walking around in cloud cuckoo land for a long, long time. Just being back in Nepal, and it was, the place is timeless. I mean, having been out in 2000 and also in 2001 on my way through to another climb, it hasn't changed, really. It's, you know, technology and everything advances, but Nepal is such a timeless, stunning country that doesn't really get... Yeah, things do change, like the cafes and stuff that you trek through. There's now Wi-Fi where we didn't really have that first time I went. So things do change from that point of view, but the country itself has remained beautiful. And it's such a spiritual place to be and to experience all that. It adds to the overall dream, really, and just being there and soaking up all of that culture. And it's an amazing, amazing experience, you know, even with what happened in 2014, to be part of, be out there was incredible, really.
Yeah.
Well, what percentage of people actually complete the climb comparison to who set out?
Yeah, the stats on this change all the time, and I've heard, years ago, when I first started getting into this and looking at the viability of climbing the mountain, I think it was one out of every 6 climbers who reached the summit would not come back. So that's like a 1 in 6 death rate, which was wow, pretty high at the time. It was quite a frightening statistic. But obviously, it's got a lot less now because more climbers are actually attempting the mountain every year. So the current stats are, I think there's about a 49% success rate of every Western climber who attempts Everest. So if you've got, you know, 300 Western climbers there in the climbing season, just less than half of them will have a realistic chance of standing on the summit. So that's still a pretty, you know, over half failure rate, really.
Flip of a coin.
So in your opinion, is it more mental or physical that enables you to get up there?
Yeah, there's certainly a bit of both. It's very mental-wise. It's very much I would say it's probably more 60% mental, 40% fitness. I mean, the fitness is not to be underestimated because it is such a colossal challenge. I mean, you've got to keep yourself some at night alone. I mean, I know I didn't get to that point, but some at night alone, you're on the go for about 20 hours at sort of extreme altitude. So there is a level of fitness required to be able to do that. But also,
what kind of weight are you carrying? What kind of weight are you?
Yeah, on summit night, you don't really have too much. With the oxygen cylinders and some of the kit you have in your bag, you maybe have 15, 20 kilos. So it's not significant. But at altitude, every bit...
soon becomes draining, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, yeah, you do feel it. But yeah, I think a big thing with Everest, is, as you picked up on there, is mental. And I think, you know, you can easily talk yourself out of it. But I know... so many climbers that have been on the mountain that have just psyched themselves out. You know, they get there, they read about it, they do their due diligence, and they think that they want this, and then they get onto the mountain and then think, wow, bigger challenge than I thought. So it's easy to psych yourself out because you do need to stay, you know, laser focused on what you're there to do. And you've got to kind of stay mentally in the zone, especially if you've got family and baggage at home. You have to sort of separate out from that on a 2 month expedition, and really it's a huge part of your chances of being successful is your ability to be able to, you know, blank out the background noise and just, as I say, just focus in on what you're there to do, which I kind of got off to a good point doing prior to what happened in 2014.
How long did it take, assuming that you completed the climb and came back down, how long would that take on average?
Yeah, the trip itself is about a 2 month trip, so you're clearing your inbox out for about 8 weeks in the UK. So leaving, you know, the airport in Manchester to getting back to Manchester, it's kind of 2 full calendar months. So it takes on average 2 weeks from landing in Kathmandu to sort of meander up to Everest. So it's a very, very slow process of acclimatization to just reach the mountain. Being on the mountain itself, you're probably giving yourself about 6 weeks of time and leeway to get up and down safely. So you can't... The thing with Everest, a lot of people assume that you just turn up at the bottom of the mountain and then you just literally rock straight up.
Yeah. That's what I've always thought. It's just...
Yeah, it doesn't quite work that way. Because the mountain's so high, there's an acclimatization process the body has to go through. So theoretically, what you end up doing on Everest is you kind of yo-yo up and down the mountain. So you'll leave base camp, you'll climb up to camp one, you'll spend a night at camp one, you'll come back down to base camp. So there's a climb high sort of sleep low analogy that a lot of climbers live by when they climb these mountains. And you keep doing that. You'll tag camp one, you'll then push up to camp two, you'll come back down to base camp, spend a few days resting. You do that process over and over again until you gradually work your way higher and higher up the mountain. And then you get to sleep over 7,000 meters, which is around about camp three on Everest. From there, you drop all the way down and you go lower than Everest. You'll go down to the valley, back to where you're getting back into greenery and trees and vegetation, and you'll take in some rich air for a few days to get all oxygen back into your body that you've lost, as I guess, for the last few weeks. From there, you then go back up to Everest and you're then ready to begin your sort of summit bid, which generally from leaving base camp is about a 6 to 8 day period of being on the mountain. So it takes a while. It's not something that most people can do in like a 2 week holiday.
Yeah. I was speaking to a guy who's been to base camp a few times and he was talking about that there's a ledge or something quite near the top.
On Everest?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm just going off him.
Yeah, yeah. You can... the mountain itself, I mean, there are certain technical aspects to the peak. I mean, Everest's probably most technical challenge is right at the bottom. This icefall that people who get to base camp, you're stood right at the bottom of the icefall. And that's possibly the one thing you should worry about. And that's, as I say, it's probably the most dangerous technical part of the entire route, and it's right at the bottom. So for any trekkers and anybody who's fortunate enough to reach base camp, you can actually stand and look directly into the icefall. And it's where I was in 2015, which I'll talk to you guys about in a little bit. But it's a dangerous part of the mountain because it's moving. It's like a living, breathing part of the mountain. So if you could imagine a waterfall, like a 2,000-foot high waterfall that's cascading over a lip of a valley higher up on the mountain, but that waterfall is completely frozen. So it's all huge, which creates huge chunks and blocks of ice, and you know, these big seracs, some of them are the size of mansions and houses, that's constantly moving and tumbling down the glacier every single day. And a climbing route has to be maintained through that, because it's the only way you can get high on Everest through Nepal is by going through the ice fall. And the way we do that is by constructing as safe a passage through as we can, by using aluminium ladders, ropes to secure yourself into, because it constantly moves. I mean, you could be on a ladder moving across a crevasse, and you know, the mountain will shift and the ladder will collapse, and then you're left dangling in thin air. So it's dangerous. It's, you know, we don't take that part of the route lightly. So a climber on an average trip to the top from Nepal probably has to go up and down that part of the mountain maybe 6 or 7 times on the way through to the top. So it's very dangerous. It's snuffed out a lot of life over the years, clearly, you know, none more so than in 2014. So it's probably part of the mountain that fills most climbers with, I would say, most dread on the way to the top of Everest. And certainly it did me in 2015 as well.
Do you know Wim Hof?
Yes, the man who can, yeah, sustain cold temperatures.
And he went up there, I think. I don't think he reached the summit, but he went up Everest in his shorts or something.
I think I didn't read too much, but I think he was trying to, wasn't he? He was trying to get up there to prove that. Yeah, I mean, that was just crazy.
He's an insane, that guy is, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
me hat off to him. So let's talk a little bit about 2015 then.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
Was it the year? Was that what it was, the year after?
It was straight, immediately. I told myself if I was going to do this thing, that I had to just get straight back on the wagon and, you know, not have any downtime here. Initially, coming home in 2014... As I've said, I was in a bit of a state of limbo, really, a state of shock. I didn't expect things to happen the way they did. So I didn't know whether that was the end of the dream, whether that was, does it end there? Is that as far as it's going to go? I mean, I was pretty miffed, to be honest. I mean, I know I was fortunate that I got to come home, but I didn't get any higher on my actual expedition in 2014 than I had done as a base camp trekker in 2000. And it cost me a lot more for the privilege in 2014. So... I spoke about it, you know. I spoke to my family, I spoke to my wife, and I expressed my, you know, my opinions about the whole thing. And everybody who was close to me was of the opinion that, you know, hey, you've had your shot here. It's time to move on. You know, you've got a young family. You know, the mountain's dangerous. It's proved that. You're fortunate that you came home. Just accept it and move on in life. And you know, it was a bitter pill to swallow, that, because as far as I was concerned, I hadn't had my shot. You know, I was a day out from Everest when what happened. And as far as I was concerned, it was denied me. So I started to put more of a positive spin on this, you know, trying to get people on board, and you know, kind of explaining, well, how would you feel if you'd always wanted to run a marathon and you got to mile 25 and then were told you can't cross the finish line? You know, it kind of felt a bit like that for me. So I was determined one way or the other that I wanted to go back and have another attempt. So it took all of my persuasive powers, should I say, to get people on board. Obviously, my wife was the biggest stumbling block, because she was adamant and determined that I wasn't going to go back. It wasn't just the danger aspect. It was also the finances as well. I mean, 2014, it cost me $45,000 to have a crack at Everest. And that money was gone. You know, there was no refunds after what happened in 2014. Everything had been paid out, so the attempt was over. You know,
what does that go to? Where does that money go for the Nepalese people?
It's a big part of it goes to the Nepalese government. They have a issue requirement for every climber on the mountain. So the legality side of things, nobody's allowed on the mountain unless they've paid the Nepalese government. It used to be about $10,000. I think it's gone up to about $11,000 now. So that was a big part of it. That goes straight to the government. Just that's your tax, if you like, for attempting to climb the mountain. But then the rest of the money, I mean, 2014, there was a guiding fee. So our guide, who'd been to the top of Everest 4 times at that point, you're paying him like a professional services fee for, you know, saying, right, you look after us on the mountain, you make sure that you know where we move, you know, when we go, when it's safe, that type of thing. So we had that security blanket. But then it's everything else. It's food on the mountain. It's oxygen. It's all the logistics that you need to safely get up and down the mountain, including your Sherpa staff and the base camp support team that you have. Everybody needs to be paid out. Because they're, you know, the Nepalese staff are there to earn money. They're there for a living. They're earning money to be able to put their kids through schooling and stuff. So they can earn a lot of money by being part of Everest Expeditions in Nepal. So it's big business, and that comes with a big price fee.
Mm. Okay, so let's go into 2015.
Yeah, okay. So in 2015, I persuaded everybody that I wanted to go back. Got my wife on board for one more final attempt.
The price great stress in the relationship there.
It was testing. It certainly took us to the limit or not. I think at one stage she actually even said to me, if you go back, I swear to God I'm gonna divorce you. So yeah, it was hard. I didn't think she was gonna come round to the idea, but eventually she did, and it was a case of, right, this is your very, very last chance. You know, if it doesn't happen this time, you do need to now move on from this. So I convinced everybody, I convinced Tamara, my wife, that, you know, what happened in 2014 was just a tragic, unfortunate incident that was never going to happen again, and then got people on board for 2015. Now, I was fortunate in 2015 because I was able to bring a little bit to the table. I had a few clients who I picked up and got friendly with on other teams when I was there the year before, and they were keen to come back, and I was able to get these guys to sign on with my team. So my expedition leader effectively said to me, because you've brought two full-paying clients onto this year's team, we can negotiate your price and bring your fee right down. Theoretically, in 2015, I was able to go back to Everest for cost price. I mean, it was still expensive. It was still, you know, a big chunk of money to pull out, but it wasn't as hideous as what I'd had to find the previous year. So everything went into, got the wheels in motion again of how to bring the money in. I was doing pushing and promoting through social media. I was able to raise a lot of money by putting on evenings and functions and dues and selling clothing. That's one of the main ways I was able to do it in 2014. I started a clothing brand, a Mount Everest themed clothing brand, which I was pushing and promoting through social media. And all the money that I was able to generate through these clothing sales, I was able to put towards the pot for me to return in 2015. So I was very fortunate that I'd built up quite a significant following on social media. And I think it wasn't because I was a world famous professional mountaineer. I think it was purely because I was just a guy off the streets, you know, the average Joe Bloggs that people resonated with, really. Thought, oh, if this guy can do something like this, then, you know, why can't we, kind of thing. So it all came together. I was able to get myself into a fitness position again and train for one more year. The money came together again. So in 2015, I was able to get back out to the mountain for another attempt. And 2015, everything was absolutely going swimmingly. You know, the mountain was in great condition. The route had been through the icefall, because what had happened the year before, the climbing route had stuck to the left-hand side of the icefall. And that's the danger area. So most of the falls and most of the avalanches that were coming down onto the icefall were over on that left area. But it was the actual route, it was the most straightforward path through the icefall, hence why it was over on the left. But in 2015, the Sherpas and the team working on the ground were able to relocate it more centrally, so it was more away from any collapses. So everything looked great. Everything looked like it was going to be a normal season, if you can say it, call it a normal season on Everest. But I think every year on the mountain, regardless of whether it's normal or not, people do die through various reasons. So it stands to reason that every year someone is going to come a cropper on the mountain. But we've done everything we could this year to make sure that it wasn't going to be as a result of a mass major world news event. So things were great. I took 10 days to reach the mountain this year. I was trekking on my own this time because I didn't need to do what I'd done the year before. So I had a great trip back up to Everest, reached base camp in good condition, and was ready to go. And, you know, not suspecting one iota what was about to happen in a week's time. But that's sadly what happened. So we began the process of moving up and down the ice fall. We'd already been in once. We'd had one foray about three quarters of the way through the route, and it was in great condition. You know, the team, everybody was moving great. We all felt in great guns. We came back down to base camp. We had a couple of days rest before we were then going to go back up onto the mountain for 3 days. The plan was to spend a night up at Camp 1 and then move up to Camp 2, where we'd spend a few days there. So we moved up on the 25th of April. We began our second move up onto Everest. We were in the ice fall. For some reason, I was having a really bad day. I'd been really dragging my tail all morning, and I'd dropped right to the back of the team, of the line of climbers. So I was effectively on my own in the ice fall this day, when it was a real pea super of weather conditions as well. It was a real thick fog that had clung around the ice. I mean, it added to the atmosphere. It was just really eerie, and you know, and you're conscious of where you are. You know, you're in probably the most dangerous part of the entire route. And at this point, I may as well have been completely on my own, because I couldn't see around me or anything. So I carried on moving up the ice that morning, and it was around about midday. And bearing in mind, we'd left about 5 o'clock in the morning. So I'd been kind of on the go for about 7 hours at this point. So I was really, really tired. I'd caught up to our leader, Tim. We were getting towards the top of the ice fall at this point. And the tents of Camp 1, which sit at the top of the ice fall. So I'd caught up to Tim. Tim had waited back for me to make sure the rest of his team cleared through the route. And that's when all hell broke loose. We climbed the last ladder, got to the top of this last vertical section of ladder. So the ladders themselves don't just go across the crevasses. They also span up huge ice cliffs. So this was this final barricade before we got to the tent. So we just cleared to the top of it. And that's when we started to hear everything around us moving and just wondering what was going on. I mean, I personally didn't for 1 second think that I was in an earthquake. I just assumed that something that we were stood on was about to collapse, as does happen in the ice fall quite regularly. So I assumed that the ground beneath us was about to be swept away. I mean, we were clipped onto the safety line, but you know, that didn't sort of make you feel any easier about what was happening. So the ground shook quite, you could feel it moving beneath your boots. It was about a good 40, 50 seconds. And then everywhere around us, you could just hear cracks and loud noises reverberating around the glacier and around the mountain. And then that stopped. And I just assumed that, oh, wow, everything's fine. We've had a lucky escape here. So we were about to, myself and Tim, we were about to head off up to camp, not knowing what had just happened exactly. But then Tim stopped us, and I've heard this sound before. I mean, it's an eerie sound anyway. If you've never heard the sound of an avalanche, it's like a freight train. That's the best way to describe it. And it's just getting louder and louder and louder as it's coming towards you. But that day, that morning, we had no visual reference because we couldn't see more than a meter in front of us. So we could hear this thing getting louder and louder and louder, sort of coming closer and closer to us, but not knowing what direction it was coming from. And when it actually hits, when an avalanche hits you, at the front of the avalanche, there's a pressure blast of air that's been built up by the snow. So we got hit with this almighty blast of air that sort of pinned us to the ground. And then I just got clung onto to the rope and sort of dug my hands into the snow and just feared for the worst. And then we were hit by a sort of a powder avalanche for about a minute. And that's probably the worst part of the entire experience, is because you don't think you're going to get out of it. You genuinely think, I'm about to be buried alive in an avalanche on Everest here. And knowing what had happened the previous year and knowing that avalanches are probably one of the number one causes of death on the mountain, it didn't bode well. Things looked grim, to say the least. But obviously I'm here to tell the story, so I did survive that. And we were able to survive what hit us. We didn't take the full brunt of it. I mean, when we both stood up after it had reverberated out, we were covered in snow. I mean, we had to completely wipe ourselves down and shake the snow off. But we'd had a very, very fortunate escape, I guess. Whatever had happened, it either shot over the top of us or we'd been protected somehow, but we were spared the full brunt of the avalanche. I mean, it was a scary experience. It's probably the closest I've been to checking out, that's for sure. So once that happened, again, not 100% sure what had happened, we continued on up to Camp 1, where we didn't know whether the rest of our team had survived or what had actually happened. And it's only when we were able to get up to camp to check in with base camp on the radios, that we discovered the true, obviously the true horror of what had actually just occurred and what had happened. And that's when we started to hear that base camp had been completely flattened by several other avalanches that had struck through camp, and also that there'd been multiple loss of life down there. And it was only then that we became abundantly clear what we'd become part of for obviously the second year running.
You don't even know what to say about that. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Was that the earthquake that was all over the news in Nepal? Is that the same one?
Right, it was, it was the big earthquake that killed 9,000 people across Nepal. It's thousands killed in the sort of the Kathmandu Valley. You know, it had massive effects all over the country. I think it was about 11,000, actually a bit higher than that, 20,000 people injured as well. So it was a major, major catastrophic event. Everest was affected because, we were about 90 miles away from the aftershock, but it was enough to rattle the mountain. And by doing what it had done that day, it shook enough snow and rock off surrounding mountains to completely and utterly flatten base camp. And there was 22 people who were down at base camp who were killed on that exact minute after when the earthquake stopped and everything came down onto base camp. As I say, that there was, you know, significant loss of life. And three of my own team members down at base camp were unfortunately killed as well. So it was a horrific to be part of that. Mm. But then that began, a period of, well, we're up on Everest here, and all of our logistics and our support beneath us has been wiped out. So where do we go from here? What do we do? You know, are we stranded on the mountain? Are we cut off from safety? Nobody knew. You know, every climber who was up on Camp 1, we didn't know what was happening. We only had our two-way radios to communicate with base camp. And I say the situation that was coming up from base camp was pretty grim, to say the least.
It must not have been your time to go, mate.
There's something keeping you.
Yeah, I think coming home now, I mean, from the experience, people generally say to me, you're either the luckiest mountaineer in the world or the unluckiest, but, you know, we can't decide.
That's all perception, isn't it?
Yeah, to be caught up in... it was the two biggest disasters in Everest history. I mean, we spent 2 days up at camp waiting it out, and the route beneath us had been completely destroyed, so it was unsafe to go back down, so we had no way to down climb. So the only way we were able to get off the mountain was in the back of a helicopter, which was taking climbers down two at a time. So because the air is so thin up at camp, on the helicopters were having to strip out everything out to reduce the weight and to keep them as buoyant and as light as possible. So we were literally, after 2 days of waiting up at camp, after further aftershocks and more avalanches, I mean, you can imagine what that does to the nerves. You know, everything would be frayed to the wire. I mean, there was a significant aftershock the day after we'd reached the camp, where everything shook again and more avalanches came down. And you just think, this is now going to be my time. You know, we're not going to survive this one. But miraculously, once again, we did. The tents took another dusting of snow, but we were able to once more, you know, get out of that. So we finally got down to base camp in helicopters. Nothing left of base camp. It was a total scene of destruction, and there was nothing to do. You know, every climber who was there had to try and recover as much of their belongings as they possibly could, and just make their way out. You know, as sad as it was, I mean, a place at base camp is, during the climbing season, you've got over 1,000 people at base camp. It's an incredible sight to see. It's like a small tented city. So you've got 300 Western climbers there, maybe attempting to reach the summit, but then you've got 700 support staff, workers, cooks. It's a huge, huge hive of activity. But when we got back down to base camp after 2 days on the mountain, we left.
Did that affect you mentally for a while after?
Not immediately. I didn't believe it did affect me. I think I was just determined to get home to my family. I mean, that was first and foremost on my mind, was to get out of the country and, you know, and take stock once I'm back in the UK. I knew I wanted to do something to help. I didn't want to just leave when so many people had died and so many families had now become destitute because their main breadwinners had been taken out. So I knew I wanted to do something. So I was trying to remain focused. And because although the dream to climb the mountain had gone again for the second year running, I knew that I wasn't done with the actual overall project of climbing Everest, if that makes sense. So, and I knew I was able to best do that back in the UK. So when I first got back home, I got my mind busy into how I could raise money to put back into Nepal. So for a good 5-6 weeks, I didn't really do any personal reflection at all. It was an emotional time reaching home. Obviously, my wife and my family went through their own experiences on the 2 days we were on the mountain, because I think they were following along with stuff that was going out on Twitter, and they'd be told that Camp One had been destroyed in an avalanche and everybody being killed. So with no contact, not being able to get in touch with my wife for a day, I think she just assumed the worst. So I think they went through their own experiences. So everybody was a bit knowing, a bit shell-shocked with what happened. But as I say, guys, I just buried myself into a project of trying to raise money to send into Nepal. And I did that the only way I knew how, which was, selling T-shirts and clothing that got me to the mountain. So I decided to do another T-shirt campaign using social media to try and promote and sell it. And we were able to sell a design that we'd come up with and donate all the proceeds into an American charity that was putting the money into the ground, and it was putting it into the families of those that had lost. So I did that. Once I'd got, once that was out of the way, and once we'd sent some money back into Nepal, it's only then that the events really hit me and things started to take stock, I guess.
For how long was it after this happened that you got into contact with your family?
For about 24 hours, I wasn't able to speak to my wife and my family. I think they just assumed the worst, because they knew there'd been this big earthquake out in Nepal. They knew that there was loss of life on Everest. She had a rough idea as to where I would be, because I gave her my itinerary for the climb. So she could kind of look and think, on this day, Ellis is going to be at base camp or he's going to be on the mountain. So I think she feared the worst, because she knew on the 25th of April that we were on our way up onto the mountain. So, and as far as she knew, 22 people had been killed from base camp and upwards. So I think for 24 hours she just assumed the absolute worst. And it was only the day after one of the guys up on the mountain had a sat phone that we were all able to get, actually, we're still here. I think it was just pure relief speaking to back home that I was able to get that out. But then, as I say, it was another day before they got further news as to what was going on. So the communication was patchy for a few days we were stranded on the mountain.
So 3 years on, where does this leave you now and your future?
Yeah, it's one of them. It's a strange thing, because in a way, I'd gone to Everest and not wanting it to sort of define me, really. It was just a childhood dream that I almost got myself into a position to achieve. And I didn't really think too much beyond climbing Everest. As far as I was concerned, I'd done my due diligence, I'd put the effort in. I didn't for one second think I was not going to climb the mountain, especially being caught up in two events like this. So it threw me for a second. Who wants to read about that? It's only when, speaking to people, that made me see, well, actually, you've got thing that's a bit more compelling here. You've got a story that's more about having dreams and then having to experience setbacks and overcoming adversity and tragedy and that type of thing. And it's only when it was put to me that way that I started to give it some serious thought. And then the summer of 2015, I began writing what became the book. Managed to then get that book out at the end of 2016. So I stayed pretty busy producing the book for a year and a half. With that came, public engagement. I was going asked to do talks to companies. Not about climbing Everest. That's not what it was about at all. It was about overcoming adversity, I guess, and having the mindset to come back from that. And for me, I stumbled into it. I had no intentions of becoming a motivational public speaker. That wasn't my aim. I just wanted to climb Everest for me. But obviously, with what I was caught up in, that sort of it threw this option my way. And people wanted to know about it. So on the back of the book, I enjoyed it. I had a couple of year period where I was in demand, really. I was getting asked to go and present at Duke of Edinburgh Awards. And I got to meet the Duke of Edinburgh himself a bit. And it was just lovely. It was a nice that people wanted to know about, not being successful, the alternative side of that when things go wrong. I guess that sort of made me who I've become now. I mean, in 2017, so last year, I had a golden opportunity to go back to Everest. An American company, a CEO from a company in America, had picked up a copy of my book, had read it, and wanted to send me back to Everest for a third attempt. in 2017. But to be honest, I think that would have been very hypocritical of me to do that, because the book itself was called It's Not About the Summit. And that was kind of a mantra and a belief system that I believed. I thought, it isn't about that, you know, the summit. At the time it was all, you know, that's why I'm going to Everest. But what I experienced, it made me believe that actually it is about that journey. And it's just getting off the couch, you know, it's making those first steps to try and achieve something in life. And that's became the philosophy that I've adopted for the last few years. And I think I've backed that up by refusing or turning down the opportunity to go back to the mountain for a third time in 2017.
I don't blame
you. Because I'm under no illusions how close I came to not coming home on both occasions, I guess, more so in 2015. And I have a wife and a young family, and I don't want the girls to grow up not knowing daddy, you know, at the end of the day. That nearly happened. So it'd be very, very selfish of me to go back for a third attempt and put my family through that again. So for now, I have no immediate plans to go back and have a third attempt at this mountain. I think the challenges and what I actually lived through on Everest for 2 years has defined me in a way, and it's experiences that I'll remember for a long, long time. But it's, you know, it wasn't my time. I wasn't meant to reach the summit, but I was meant to get some takeout from it. And I believe that. I think, you know, it's made me possibly a stronger, more determined person by not reaching the summit, by being through no fault of my own, obviously. Mm. It was taken away from me twice, and I can live with that. You know, I think if I'd have gone to Everest and not climbed it because I just wasn't fit enough or I got ill, that would be harder to take than what actually happened to me, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So where can people find you if they're interested in your work?
Yeah, if anybody wants to connect with me, I mean, I'm big on social media still. I do have an Everest website. It's obviously www.everest-dream.com. A lot of the products that I used to sell on the run to the Everest expedition, they're still on there, so people can sort of connect with me on that. There's a blog there. Or Facebook, you know, Everest Dream is a Facebook page that I'm still pretty active on, because I promote and push the book through there and any sort of public speaking type talks and work I do. So, and I'm always happy to chat with people, and I get a lot of people asking me for advice on doing challenges, you know, trekking to Everest, doing Kilimanjaro, things like this. And I'm always happy to spend a few moments with people, you know, giving them some advice and opinions. So yeah, that's probably the best way to connect with me.
That's great.
Is the book on Amazon as well?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for asking that. Yeah, the book, it's called Everest, It's Not About the Summit. It is available on Amazon. I crowdfunded the actual paperback version of that at the end of November, and only recently at the back end of 2017 I did the same thing again for the hardcover version of the book, because there was one or two people asking for that. So there are some hardcover versions of it. It's the Kindle versions there, and obviously the paperback's still there. So yeah, it's on Amazon, and it's doing okay. It's still holding its own.
Cool. Brilliant. Thanks a lot for joining us. I hope people took a lot of value from it, so thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thanks guys. Enjoyed it.
Thanks, Alice.
Great. All the best. Thanks a lot for coming on.
No worries. You too, guys.
Cheers. Bye.